Deconstruct 2006 presents Jeremy Keith, The Joy of API.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not going to be talking about big business benefits or, you know, business models or anything like that. This is going to be a much more sort of a personal look at APIs. I'm not from Yahoo, I'm not from Amazon, not from a big company. I'm just a lone developer, and I want to talk about my experiences. Specifically, I wanted to talk about the fun, the happiness that you get from APIs, because you can get a lot of joy out of it. Mostly, though, I just want to talk about me. So that's what I'll be doing for the next 45 minutes. So joy, where do we get joy from? Ignoring the obvious, you know, answers to that question, let's focus specifically on technology. And where does joy and technology intersect? And I'm going to cast my mind back to the first time I remember getting joy out of technology. Did anybody else have a ZX81? Yeah? Okay, cool. 1K. 1K of memory was what you had to work with this. You had to be very creative, but it was a lot of fun. You know, everyone's done it, right? 10, print, 20, go to 10. Okay, we've all done it. It's just fun playing around. Later on, we all got our spectrums, and we started playing adventure games and stuff like that, Thorin Sings of Gold. Many, many years later, I left computers aside. I sort of, you know, went off wandering, hitchhiking and busking around Europe for a while, and many years later, I came across the web, and I didn't get the web at first. Till I came across this site, Frey.com, which was years ahead of its time. I was surfing around, I was looking at all these websites, and I was like, I don't get it. I don't get why the web is big. And I came across Frey.com, and I got it, because I had an emotional reaction. What it was stories. People were telling stories, and the design was always driven by the story. The story would drive the design, which is something I've held on to this day. Frey made me want to learn HTML. And that was where I found joy, was with HTML. This idea of marking stuff up with tags, I loved it. I really got into it. And I decided I wanted to do this. I wanted to play around with this. So at the time, I was living in Germany and playing in a band. And we decided we should have one of these newfangled website things. So I said, I'll try it. I'll do it. I want to get into this. So I did. This is my very first website. I'm burying my soul here by showing this. You know, it's not too bad. It's not a GeoCities page, at least, right? But this is, 1998 I built this, so this is going back a ways. It was really good fun. I really enjoyed it. And I picked up skills. So I was picking up, you know, some Photoshop skills, some HTML skills. And I found a lot of the skills I picked up were always on personal projects like this. I made my own website, adactio.com. This is what it used to look like. It was full of DHTML stuff whizzing around. Remember the 90s, the kind of stuff we got up to? This was the epitome of gratuitous effects. It's terrible, really. But I learned JavaScript, for what it's worth. You know, at the time, that sort of DHTML stuff wasn't much fun to do. There wasn't much joy to be had from DHTML. But I was learning. I was learning new stuff by doing these personal projects. And then I created this site. And this is a community site built around Irish music. And here, it turned into a big site with all these tunes and albums and discussions. So my skill that I needed to learn here was database skills. And I was learning PHP and MySQL, all this stuff. So I was having fun and picking up these new skills. But there's a particular part of this site I want to draw your attention to. That's down at the end of navigation where it says shop. Because on this site, you can go through to the shop. There's a search thing at the top, and you search Amazon from this site, from thesession.org. So I've typed in the name of a band, I get the results, I click through, and I get to display all that information in my site, marked up the way I want it, looking the way I want it. And that's all possible because of Amazon's API, exactly what Jeff was talking about earlier. So this was something I just wanted to mess around with. I knew it would add value to my own site, and that it was probably going to be some fun. And it was relatively painless because of this documentation that Amazon provides. It provides pretty much everything you need to know. There's documentation, but more importantly, there's examples, because that's how I learn stuff. I look at examples and I pick apart the code. Right? I mean, view source, okay? That's how I learned HTML, that's how I learned JavaScript, CSS. So this is the equivalent of view source. It's showing you, here's what you need to do to put together a query to get some information in an XML file. And that's pretty cool. What's interesting, though, is down the bottom, you'll see that there's general request parameters. And one of those is XSL. It's one of the coolest things that Amazon's web services allow you to do. They allow you to specify an XSL file, and you can mash up the XML and the XSL and output it the way you want to do it. So let me show you that. Warning, code ahead. But it's sort of pseudocode, and it's not going to get very complex. It's just more the idea of it. How do you use these web services? I mean, really nitty-gritty, how do you even start to use them? You need some kind of server-side language to do this. I was using PHP, so that's what I'm using here. So first of all, you begin with a URL. This is the URL to the particular method on the Amazon web service. You start with a URL, and you start adding all these parameters to it. So my Amazon associate ID, so I'll make some money off any sales. My API key. Most APIs make you sign up first. They give you a unique key, and you have to use that in every request you make. So there's mine. Don't use it. The important one in red there is I'm pointing to an XSL file. I'm saying, don't send me back raw XML. Before you send the result back to me, run it through that XSL file. So I put all of those parameters onto the URL, and finally I just spit out what's left. So I'm using a very simple PHP function to do that. Here's what the Amazon Web Service would send back, roughly. This is a very simplified version, but it's an XML file full of stuff. And some of the stuff in there is the information I want to get out. So there's the name of the band, there's the name of the album. And that's what I want to get out, and I want to mark it up in markup. So I run that through an XSLT file. I do a transformation. Now, XSL is an interesting one because you see it's tag-based. It's like XML, but it's all, so it's this declarative language, but it's also got some programmatic aspects to it because you can select things, you can do loops. It's a strange mixture of programming and markup. A lot of people have a love-hate relationship with it. It's actually pretty powerful, and it's a good skill to have. And the nice thing is then you mix it up with regular markup. So I'm mixing it up with HTML, and it's like a template language. It will insert the relevant data in there, and the result is that I get markup with the empty spots filled in with the data I wanted. And then I can display that on my site like that. And that was a lot of fun. That was actually joyful. I got a lot of fun out of doing that. And, you know, I make a bit of money when people click through, but that wasn't really my reason for doing it. This is all possible because of this idea called REST, which supposedly stands for Representational State Transfer. And it's more an idea about how to build these services together. And there's a number of different sort of thinking behind what makes something RESTful. But basically what it comes down to is you have these resources that are uniquely addressable, usually through a URL, and it's stateless. There's no keeping track of who's logged in or who's not. And if this kind of thing looks familiar, this idea of a stateless, uniquely addressable resources, that's because that's the web. That's how the World Wide Web was built, using a RESTful methodology, really. It's pretty easy, because once you get your head around that, you have to do is put together a URL and grab that, and there's your information from a third-party service. The other idea, the sort of the opposite to REST, is something called SOAP, which is an acronym, S-O-A-P, and I think we all know what that stands for. And I'm not going to go into too much detail about SOAP, because it's far too complex. Unnecessarily complex, really. I have played around with SOAP. I had to, because one of the other things I wanted to put on that site was Google search. I wanted people to be able to do everything from my site. I didn't want them to have to go off to Google just to do a search. And you can use Google's API to get searches on your own site, but it's only SOAP. You have to use SOAP. And I'm not even going to go into technical details. Basically, you have to create an XML file, send that off, and then you get the XML file. Way too complex. Not much joy to be had. It would be nice if Google provided a RESTful interface. I did do it, and you know, I got this interface on my site into Google's search results, which is nice, but not much fun. Where I did get joy was when I started using Flickr. I love Flickr. I really like Flickr. I started using it when I came back from South by Southwest last year. Everybody was using Flickr, and I decided I needed to check this out. And I started taking pictures, putting them up there. You know, I was reluctant at first, because I already had image galleries on my own site. I didn't really want a third party hosting my images, but they did such a good job, I decided to go with them. And then I started exploring other services to host my stuff. So Delicious for hosting bookmarks, and started using Upcoming for keeping track of events and stuff like this. So a lot of my data started going outwards. It was other services were providing the infrastructure. So what happened was I had my own website, And then all around that, all over the web, there was all these bits of me. So Amazon would have my wish list, and Flickr is where I'm keeping my pictures. Delicious, that's where my bookmarks are, and Upcoming, that's where all my events are. So they're all over the place, scattered over the web, and I wanted to be able to draw them into that central location, which is my own site. And that was possible because of APIs. Flickr provides the loads and loads of methods. You can do just about anything. Delicious also provides an API. A little trickier, it must be said, because it requires a secure authentication thing. But you can still get it, all your bookmarks. Upcoming, you can also get it, events and stuff. Again, not quite as friendly as Flickr's, but pretty powerful. And here's how they all pretty much work. Again, you begin with the URL. Now, none of these are providing XSLT transformations, which is a bit of a shame, and it would be nice if they did. So I have to parse them some other way. So I begin with a URL, and in this case, I decided to use PHP 5's DOM functions, because I was familiar with the DOM already from client-side DOM scripting. So I load in the document, it turns into a DOM structure, and then I can just go through it using the usual DOM methods that I'm used to from JavaScript, you know, get elements by tag name. So that's one of the nice things about the DOM is you get to recycle your knowledge. And then I can spit it out onto the screen, whatever I want. My original idea was I would bring this into my blog, because I have a sidebar down the side, and I thought, oh, I'll just pull in, you know, what lots of other people are doing, a couple of Flickr pics, and the next few events I'll be going to on Upcoming, and maybe a couple of Delicious links. But it grew and grew and grew into this sort of monster where I ended up creating a whole subdomain, Adactio Elsewhere, to hold all of this stuff. So I didn't just pull in my Flickr pics. I pulled in my Flickr pics, the last few Flickr pics from my contacts, also the list of all my contacts. And you don't just have to look at my pictures. If you can click, you can click on anybody's name, and then you'll see their pictures and their contacts' pictures, which is one of the funnest things about Flickr is following these trails. You know, here are my pictures. This person's a friend. Here's this person's pictures. Here's the pictures of their friend. And you end up, you know, going through this whole network of pictures. Great fun. Amazon, as well as doing the search that I was doing on the other site, I already had the code for that, so I just threw it in there. Also having my wish list here, so I can, you know, easy access to it. And Delicious, pulling in the last links, also being able to search my links straight from this one place. And Upcoming, just grab the newest events. All on one page, all in an Ajax-y sort of interface, because that was something else I was learning about at the time. So, pretty good fun. Let's see how they stacked up. Let's rate the APIs of these various services. And I'm going to rate them by the amount of power you get from them, documentation, and just plain that joy, that indefinable something. So, first of all, the power. Flickr provides APIs into an API into just about everything. I think the only thing you can't do with the Flickr API is get the comments. You can get the number of comments on a photograph, but you can't get the actual comments on a photograph. But pretty much everything else you can do yourself. You could create a one-to-one copy of Flickr, almost, just using their APIs. And this is probably because they use the API themselves. They eat their own dog food. Now, Amazon is very powerful as well. Again, you could create an entire Amazon of your own, pretty much, and put a nicer interface on it and put nicer markup in there. At some point, you do have to go out and go to the check-in process. So you can't quite go all the way through, but pretty close. Delicious and Upcoming, yeah, a little tricky, got to say. They make you jump through a lot of hoops. You can't just grab all the information about an event. You have to grab the event ID, and then you have to grab the location ID, and then do different methods for each one of those to get the details. You know, they make you jump through loops. Delicious, the thing that's kind of tricky, is you have a lot of access to your own bookmarks, but not so much access to other people's. So there's kind of limited room for mashups that involve other people's bookmarks there. Documentation, let's see how they did. Pretty good. Both Flickr and Amazon scored well. They've got good online documentation on their sites, but almost more importantly, they have good communities. There's mailing lists, and Flickr, of course, is a Flickr group. Good place to go and discuss. The Flickr mailing list, you know, the Flickr developers themselves hang out there, so you can get answers fairly quickly from the people who really know their stuff. Amazon, there's a lot of documentation on the site. It's improving all the time. It's something they keep putting a lot of effort into. Delicious and Upcoming, less so, but you have to remember where they came from. You know, they were small startups, and they were only bought out by Yahoo fairly recently, so basically a couple of guys in their bedroom doing each of those services. So their documentation is understandably a little thinner on the ground. So let's see the final scores, please. How did the APIs do? And the winner there is Flickr for joy. And It's partly down to the subject matter. It's just so much fun messing around with photographs. Amazon is good. Amazon came second. But you're dealing with products and shopping and stuff like that. And there's a lot of fun to be had there. But there's just something sexier about photographs, I think. So Flickr has a bit of an unfair advantage. And the others did pretty well. So there's the scorecard. And those are just four services. There are hundreds, if not thousands, more APIs out there. This site keeps track of all the different services that are out there being provided by all these providers. There's big, from the very big to the very small, there are a lot of APIs out there. And what this cornucopia of APIs creates is a parallel web. Instead of being a web of documents, it's like a web of data. The kind of data you get, well, is identity, for one. This is my Flickr photographs, my delicious things, all of these things that are mine. The ultimate identity API was when we can actually, safely store username, passwords, credit cards in the third party and have that trusted. That's still future talk. But right now, my things. Events, obviously, so upcoming for that. Eventful, there's a whole bunch of services based around events. Relationships, that's where all the social networking stuff comes into it. There's a lot of social networking sites out there, all built pretty much the same way. Most of them have APIs. And here's one that I haven't even touched on, location. And location is a really big one. And location's kind of like I said, Flickr was fun because of the subject matter. Location is really fun because of the subject matter. Dealing with maps is an awful lot of fun. I remember the joy I had when Google Maps came out. Does anyone remember what it used to be like when you'd have to, try and browse a map and all you had was MapQuest? I mean, these days, if I come across a MapQuest image on a website, I try and drag it. I forget that it's just an image. I've gotten so used to Google Maps and the other great maps that are out there now, I expect to be able to pan around a map. I had so much fun with Google Maps when it came out, not doing anything useful, just browsing the world, just looking at landmarks. It was very enjoyable. And it wasn't long before people started using Google Maps for their own purposes. And this is something that gets pulled up again and again, the ChicagoCrime.org, where Adrian Hilavati mashed up crime statistics for Chicago with Google Maps. So you could see which neighborhoods were the most dangerous. Here are the first-degree murders in Chicago. And you can figure out what neighborhoods you want to stay away from. And everyone brings this up as a good example of a mashup. Why I'm bringing it up of interest is that this was built before there was an API for Google Maps. The interesting thing about Google Maps is it's not to do with sending XML from a server. It's all JavaScript. And JavaScript, you can view source. Now, they did obfuscate everything, and there was line break stripped out. But if you had the time, you could go in, you could view source, you could figure out how Google was doing it, and you could create your own mashup, which is exactly what happened here. And this is probably what got the Google guys thinking, people could probably do some very cool stuff if we released this API publicly, which they did. So that's a good example. I've seen some other ones I really like. Eric Meyer did this one, which is the high-yield detonation simulator. After he had an argument one evening with somebody at dinner, whether, New Jersey would get blown off the map if New York got hit by a bomb. So you can put in a location and the amount of kilotons. So this is a 100-kiloton bomb dropping on Brighton, dropping actually on the Corn Exchange. It's okay. The university survives. That's a nice one. My absolute favorite mashup with Google Maps is this thing called Overplot, where they've taken a blog. Has anybody heard of Overheard in New York? It's this blog where people submit little snippets of conversation they overheard in the street. They submit the little snippet. They also submit where they heard it, corner of 5th and Broadway or whatever. Well, this guy took the entire archive of that site by just going through the Google Reader, RSS Reader, mashed it up with the maps to create this map of New York with all the conversations mapped onto it. And you can zoom in and you see all the conversations on each street corner. And you can zoom in, you can start, eavesdropping. And you get the context. That's the really great thing about maps. It's one thing to read, that this occurred on a street corner. It's another thing when you can actually see the surrounding area. And you've loved it. It's a complete time sink. If you go to this site, be prepared to spend hours, hours, looking around. It's great. That's the great thing, context. Context is something that maps do really well. Something similar to this is something that Gawker did. They put together the Gawker Stalker, because they used to have people call in celebrity sightings. Hey, George Clooney is having lunch at this restaurant downtown. Well, they took all these sightings again, and they mashed it up with location. George Clooney hates this site. He really doesn't like it. So you can see celebrities being stalked all over the place. And I decided I wanted to try messing around with this. I wanted to check out the API. So I found an opportunity to mess with Google Maps this year at South by Southwest. There was a lot of parties going on, and I'd gotten together all the parties and written them all up on an HTML page, marked them all up, and I wanted to mix it up with Google Maps so that I could see how far apart these parties were. And then I could decide which ones I could go to and which ones I could avoid. So, you know, you click on a particular place and say, well, that's where it is, right there, right where the big beer logo is. And then click on other places and you could decide, well, that party's too far. You get a lot more context from maps. It was really good fun. This is an idea I recycled for Deconstruct. Same thing. I had all this information about, you know, places we can go grab some lunch, pubs that have free Wi-Fi. And instead of just providing that in text form, mash it up with a map, and then you can see how far away, you know, there, that's how far away the best Japanese restaurant in Brighton is from the Corn Exchange. And then you can make a decision based on that. So like I said, it's not XML this time, it's JavaScript. And you do have to know some JavaScript. And it was kind of fun. And one of the interesting things, this is something that Paul mentioned, Google were the first out the door with a mapping API. Yahoo followed, and they very wisely pretty much copied the Google Maps API. In fact, I decided just to play around. I wanted to re-implement this, but using Yahoo Maps. And all I had to do most of the time was change the letter G to the letter Y, and everything just worked. I ended up sticking with Google because this is how the Yahoo equivalent appears. Yeah, not so much context. I'm not getting quite the information I need out of that. But I do not blame Yahoo, because the mapping situation, as Paul pointed out, and Simon, is very complicated. The data providers, it is very annoying. Which is why it'd be great to get those guys out of the picture. And, you know, we should be providing the data, which is something that these guys are doing, OpenStreetMap.org. They're mapping the world from a ground-up way. Instead of this top-down, you know, data is coming from these mapping providers, these guys are going out there and they're mapping the street maps. And they're having a workshop tomorrow here in Brighton. And we'll try and map as much of Brighton as we can. It's going to be a lot of fun. I recommend everyone to come along. And they have an API, which is great. There's an associated project called Free the Postcode, because the Royal Mail has a monopoly on postcode lookups in this country, and they charge for that data. But we all know our own postcodes. If you could just say, here's my postcode, here's my location, latitude, longitude. If everybody did that, then we could have a free API for postcodes, which would be great. So all this data is getting freed. This web of data, you know, people want that data to be free. Parallel to this web of data, there's something else going on. There's the live web. Data tend to be, you know, tends to be fairly static. Amazon products, Flickr pictures, they're there. You can go to them anytime. But there's a lot of stuff going on the web now that's just like drinking from the fire hose. There's just so much going on. And mostly through the RSS is the best way of getting access to this stuff, because it's so fast. You need some way of keeping track of it. And the other way of making sense of it is tagging. And a site that's really done the best job of combining these two things together and keeping track of all these conversations, there's lots of sites doing this, but Technorati is particularly interesting for keeping track of the live web. And one of the reasons why I find it interesting is the fact that it provides an API. Again, RESTful, you just point your code at a URL, send it the parameters, and you get back XML, and you have to parse that XML. So I decided to use the power of the live web on my own site. I started tagging my own posts a while back. So you can see I've got my own posts. And then I added in calls to the APIs for Delicious to get my own links, and to Technorati to see what other people are saying about the same tags, and then display that in the same page. So this is, first of all, who's linking to this site. That's really useful. You know, it's like what you'd use stats for, but here I get it in line. Who's talking about what I've just blogged right now, this minute? Well, I can get that information from Technorati. And who's using the same tags? In a very meta move, this is who's tagging with tagging, so I can keep track of all of that in one place. And it was good fun. The API is pretty straightforward for Technorati. Sadly, it's pretty flaky, it must be said. Technorati could do with some new servers, I think, because it tends to drop a fair bit. That's just my own personal experience. Everything I'm saying here is my own personal experience, and that was mine with the Technorati API. It's potentially fun, a little bit flaky, wouldn't want to rely on it too much. There's a problem with all of these APIs, really, and it's the fact that you do need to know your stuff. It is kind of rocket science. You can't just get started straight away. Most of all, you need to know about XML. Apart from the Google Maps and the Yahoo Maps, those the ones based around JavaScript, it all comes down to XML most of the time, and you have to know your way around XML. You have to know ways of parsing XML like XSLT. That's a good, useful skill to have, like I said, particularly for the Amazon services. If you are going to use the maps, you need to know your JavaScript. I mean, they make it as painless as possible for you, but you still need to know this stuff so you can understand what's going on. And most of the time, you need some server-side language to do the heavy lifting for you. What that means is that mashing around with APIs and doing all this fun stuff is limited to kind of the alpha geeks, the people who know this stuff. It's good fun to play around with it, but it's a bit of a shame that everybody can't join in the fun. Now, some people are trying to change that. There's some services out there that try and bring APIs to the masses. There's a service called Ning, with the idea being that you take existing mashups, you clone it, you mess around with it, you do your own thing. I'm not sure how well this works, really. I don't think it's very clear describing how it works and who it's aimed at. But the idea is good, to free APIs up for everybody, not just the geek developers. Another interesting one is called Dapper, where you point it at some pages. Let's say there's a site that doesn't have an API, and you want to mess around with that site's data. Well, you start surfing that site through this Dapper browser, and you say, okay, on this page, this is a headline, and that's a description, okay? And on this page, that's a headline, that's a description. And you show it a few pages, and it sort of gets the idea, and it says, oh, okay, I see how this site is built, and then it can construct an API for you to use. Really, it's like a very clever form of screen scraping. But that's what people are going to do anyway. If you don't provide an API, people are going to just get the data. If they really want the data, they're going to get it anyway by screen scraping. So it's an interesting way of you know, trying to open up every website to have APIs. But I don't know how well that's going to work. So this web of data, as I said, we've got identity, events, relationships, and location. And right now, it's JavaScript, especially for location, XML for everything else, and some server-side language. But there's this wonderful movement whereby all of these bits of data can be done very simply by anyone. For instance, identity, we have the H card, just a couple of class names in markup, and you're essentially creating an API for your identity. Events, we have H calendar. It maps events to some very simple class names. Relationships, XFN, a fairly simple way of doing it, but you'd be surprised how far it scales. And location, we have geo-coordinates. And if more people used all of these little formats, that would be great. These are micro formats, very basic, very simple, and it's almost a way of turning the entire web into one giant API. You've seen it at work already on the back network, where we're using the XFN relationship to join people up like this, and mashing it up with the live web through things like RSS and tagging, the very things I mentioned. Mash that up with relationships, and then you get some interesting views, a relationship cloud of who knows who. So they work extremely well. They're meant to be very simple, but they scale up remarkably well. And that's the thing about microformats. It's like I've gone on this journey from learning plain old HTML back in the day when I built that first website for my band. And I learned all those other technologies. I learned JavaScript, and I learned the PHP and the MySQL, and then messed around with the APIs. And I did get a lot of fun out of messing with the APIs. But right now, I have to say where I'm getting the most joy is from microformats, because it has rekindled the joy of HTML, that original joy I got when I first went online. That is why I've organized a fairly impromptu microformats picnic, because I want to talk about microformats a lot more, and I'm going to be done here in a few minutes. So out the back, there's a park. The weather looks pretty nice today. I've ordered some sandwiches, but I think you're going to have to bring some food with you. Let's all meet up in the park, and we can talk about microformats, because I'm very excited about them. And now I would like to hear your thoughts about other things I've talked to here, APIs, mashups, anything like that. If you want any of the URLs that I've talked about today, I've put them all up online at this URL here, adactio.com/extras/joyofapi. You've been very gracious in listening to me babble on about myself today, so thank you very much. Okay, hands up for questions.
Sorry, Jeremy. You say that it's a shame that the alpha geeks are the only people who can use these APIs.
Yes.
But can you think of a use case where someone who wasn't a geek would even want to use these things?
Yeah. You've got a blog. You don't need to be a geek to have a blog. You don't need to be a geek to have a LiveJournal account or a TypePad account or to have your own website or to have a website about your favorite pets. That was the great thing about the web. That was what made the web explode when it was first introduced, was that anybody could do it. Now, of course, what that meant was it was a pretty sloppy web, right? And browsers were very forgiving in the markup that they allowed people to use and tried to do the best job they could anyway. But because of that, because anybody could create a website, once they knew a bit of HTML, the web exploded. And there's no reason why those same people should be excluded from getting the benefits of things like maps and events and all this other data. So anybody, you know, because you don't have to be a geek to have a website, so you shouldn't have to be a geek to use an API. Kind of the spirit of the original web, really. We had one over the side here, I think.
Yeah, this isn't so much a question. It's just an interesting thing that's come out of both your talk and Paul and Simon's, which is the question earlier about what happens when this goes away. And then you used your example of trying to flick between Google and Yahoo Maps. There's another service that people might be interested in out there, which is nothing to do with me. It's called Mapstraction.
Yeah.
And it's actually... So the trick is actually going... An API abstracts out what an application does into a series of methods, and the trick is then to abstract again on top of that. So what Mapstraction does, it's one library, it's JavaScript, you put it in a page, and you say, you know, I want a map of this place with a pin, with a pop-up, and then one global variable sets whether it's on Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, or OpenStreetMap. The point being that then when Google charge for their maps, you just change one variable and you move over to a competitor. But the trick is, you can do that for almost anything else. You can like layer.
Yeah, it will be good to see more of these sort of libraries of libraries, these sort of meta APIs that let you just switch between data providers at your call. But as Paul pointed out, that's the great thing about a lot of these APIs. The first one to market gets to dictate the scene. And other APIs, if they want to compete, they had better follow the same sort of structure in their API, or nobody's going to use it. That's the great thing. Now, one of the other things I want to mention about, you know, what if these services go away, what happens to my data and stuff. That's one of the benefits of APIs. For instance, with Flickr, why should I trust Flickr with my photographs? Well, because of the API, you know you'll be able to get your photographs out anytime you want. I'm not just talking about the alpha geeks who can code up something to get their data out. There's third-party providers who will burn all your Flickr pics to DVD. If you authorize them, you give them your Flickr username, password, and they will do the burning for you using the API. So APIs actually encourage trust. They say, your data is safe with us. Look, we've got an API. Anytime you want, you'll be able to take your data with you.
Hi. You already mentioned that on your own site you've experienced some flakiness where things have gone down. Surely the more of these APIs you include in them, the more calls you're making to more different services on different servers, and the more unstable you're making your own site, really. I mean, are there ways around that to kind of mitigate that risk?
Well, something like Mapstraction, like you're saying, if you had something that you can easily flick between providers, you say, Google Maps is being really flaky today, I'm switching over to Yahoo Maps. The more providers they are, the more times you have that option. But also the way you build things. You don't want to make these things mission critical, really, I suppose. But you can have, you know, it's like Unix pipes. You have lots of these different sort of things going on at once. But this idea of relying on other services isn't anything new. Unless you're hosting your site yourself, you're probably relying on a third-party hosting provider. Your stats package is probably, you know, sitting off somewhere. You're relying on some other third party for that. So this idea of relying on third parties for sometimes very mission-critical stuff isn't really new. Most of us rely on third parties for email, which is about as critical as it gets. So this idea of trust and trusting data providers isn't that new, really. It's just taking it to the next level.
Hi, Jeremy. Just on the, you know, the flakiness of services, one thing that I've seen that I've been doing on my own site is it is sometimes a good idea to do some caching so that you don't always try to hit the latest live data, but just mitigating it by, I don't know, if you can afford to have like 10, 15, 20 minutes stale data, that kind of helps overcome kind of initial problems if the server just happens to be down or being kind of overly busy.
Yeah, that's a savvy thing to do. I'm not tech-savvy enough to do that. Glenn, when he built the back network, he is tech-savvy. So he's not calling Flickr every time. He set a polling time, which, you know, a few weeks ago, he was just polling Flickr once a day. As it comes up to deconstruct, he's polling more and more often. So he gets closer to the live feed on the day of deconstruct. But, yeah, caching is generally a good idea. If I was smart, I would do that more. But I'm not really clever enough.
Thanks, Jeremy. So I've heard no offense to him, Tontek speak on this at least three times over the last 3.5 years, and you just summed up, especially the microformats, in a way that makes sense. Now, can I request that the two of you speak together in the future, so that way you will give the broad, good background, and then he can give the detail?
Well, we actually did at South by Southwest last year. Tantek talked about microformats and gave the whole background of them. And then he had a few of us come up and do the implementation. So Norm was there, and he showed off Yahoo Europe using HReviews. And I went up and showed all the parties in Austin, because that was what I had used microformats for. Yeah, I should mention, I've started using microformats everywhere. So a lot of those mashups you would have seen were using Google Maps. So the parties in Austin, the deconstruct location page, all of that's marked up in microformats. And like I say, that makes your website an API straight away. The schedule for deconstruct, that was marked up in hCalendar. You would have seen a link in the sidebar to a third-party service, which is hosted on Technorati, which will turn the hCalendar into an actual iCal that you can subscribe to. And then you can put that on your mobile phone. If the web page gets updated, the calendar will get updated as well. You get to take this data with you. You don't have to duplicate the data. It's just so easy to do. I've just started doing it automatically now and things. And I want to try and turn as many of my websites as possible into APIs. And the easiest way to do that is by providing microformats. And a lot of companies, when you say to them, I mean, Paul and Simon made a great job of selling the benefits of providing an API and of having an API if you're a company. But, you know, you have to convince people, as someone mentioned, you know, to do this, to put the money and to put the effort in, and it can be a lot of hassle. Microformats are a nice starting point. If you just convince people, look, and you don't even have to tell them, just throw in a few class names, it's as simple as that, straight away you've allowed access to your data. That's what Norm did at Yahoo Europe. He just threw in a few class names on Yahoo Local, I think it was, and suddenly there was thousands and thousands and thousands of HReviews and HCards and all sort of stuff on the web. Anybody could go out there with a parser and could use that data. There was essentially a brand new API the next morning. So it's a good way to start. You know, APIs can be intimidating, and microformats are a nice sort of way of getting in the door of the API mentality, this idea of opening up my data.
Hi there. I'm the editor of a big cultural website called the 24-Hour Museum. We've done RSS for nearly 4 years now. Fantastic. It's the bloodstream that makes everything work and join together. We're really fascinated with APIs and web services, and we've got fantastic live database, which is added to and kept live all the time by museums and galleries and heritage sites all over Britain. What worries me is just how long have we got if we are looking to build an API interface. If it takes us 6 months to get it together, how long have we got of good, solid, reliable, live working with that API interface, with those standards, before things move on again? Because this is what's sort of maybe holding back the big cultural websites, the government funders, and this kind of stuff. This is what's holding us back.
Okay, did everyone hear the question? It was about how do you get started building an API? It could take 6 months. It's what's holding people back. It seems like such a complicated thing to do. And in 6 months' time, it might be out of date, you know. You're going to have to go to the next version of your API. I would say you already have an API because you're providing RSS feeds. RSS is XML. It's a URL. It's a RESTful interface onto your data. I mean, you've probably got lists, right? Lists of things that you can... If you can provide an RSS equivalent for everything on your site, that's wonderful. And a lot of sites do this already. You know, Flickr Upcoming, all of these sites. Pretty much anything you can get in a list, you can get as an RSS feed. So my latest pictures from my friends, my latest events, links tagged with a certain tag, as well as being able to get that on the website or through the official API, which is more complex, there's always an RSS feed for this stuff because it's generally pretty easy to put an RSS feed together. It's always got the same structure, an item with a description and a title and a URL. That's the important bit. And once you've got that, you already have an API because people can just grab that URL and parse it because it's XML, and do what they want with it. So providing RSS is an API. Now, if you also introduce microformats on the site, anywhere where you have listings, you could use hlistings, anywhere where it's reviews, hreview, all of these little bits of data, then if you don't have the budget and the time to put it into an API, that's where you should start, with just doing the small stuff. It's pretty simple. But RSS is a great way to start because RSS is an API. It's a RESTful interface onto data. So RSS, very cool stuff. Atom as well. I'm not going to get into a flame war. Thanks for the questions. Great stuff.